SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, in association with the Medical News Network and Silent Majority Speaks, are pleased to present an investigative report on what doctors need to know about COVID-19. This is an interview with Russell Blaylock, conducted on January 30th, 2024. COVID-19 and its vaccine have produced a widespread disease which is the most severe in the last 100 years. It has killed millions of people, injured millions more, and its future complications are unknown, but they are unfolding. Thousands of papers have been written, information has been suppressed, governments have dictated treatments, healthcare regulations have been proposed. Most physicians in the world are not acquainted with or do not know the basic biology of the virus, the vaccine, or its complications. Patients worldwide are confused by the changing information from the government, media, and other sources. This is the first of SNI Digital's investigative reports. These reports are done to provide doctors and the public with the known facts about this disease and its effects and other subjects of great concern to physicians. This program is in 2 one-hour segments. The material discussed is extensive and thoroughly researched. Every statement can be supported by factual information as referenced. SNI Digital's policy is to address issues of concern to physicians all over the world. We present the facts, and you decide what you will do. Our major concern is that the patient should come first. We hope you enjoy these investigative reports. Thank you very much for watching. The interviewee in this series will be Russell L. Blaylock. He's the CEO of Theoretical Neuroscience Research, the Associate Editor-in-Chief of the Neuroinflammation Section of Surgical Neurology International, an internet journal which is read and seen in 239 countries all over the world. He's the creator and editor of the Blaylock Wellness Report, which is published monthly, and the author of multiple books and scientific papers. Some of the books which Dr. Blaylock has written are Natural Solutions for Liver Cure, Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients, His Prescription for Natural Health, a book on excitotoxins, a subject which he discusses in more detail in this interview. Along with Dr. Ausman, they co-authored a publication entitled The China Virus, What is the Truth? All of these books are available on Amazon.com. The book, The China Virus, What is the Truth, is available free as an ebook, SNI.global. Go to menu, and from menu, go to ebooks, and you will see the book. Dr. Blaylock has also written a series of articles, a number of which address COVID. These articles have been published in Surgical Neurology International, and he's also written articles on immunoexcitotoxicity, a concept which he has worked on for the past 10 years, which he thinks is fundamental to the neurodegenerative diseases involving the immune system activation. He's also written this paper on the biochemical basis of neurodegenerative disease, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and the role of immunoexcitotoxicity in those diseases, and published articles on Parkinson's disease specifically. His Blaylock Wellness Report is published monthly. The website is indicated on the bottom. Hello, everyone. I'm James Ausman. I'm here with Russell Blaylock, who's a a physician who's going to be our expert today, talking about the topic of what doctors need to know about COVID-19. And as a way of introduction, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some things that have gone on, just to remind you of what the past history is. Back in about the end of 2019, 2020, we became aware that there was an infection in China. It was eventually labeled COVID-19, or sometimes called the China virus. It began to spread worldwide. It went to Europe, then it traveled all over the world. It was then called a pandemic. And after that, a whole series of events occurred because people were fearful that this was going to cause death. They were told that it was a very threatening disease. They knew about the serious problems that were being reported in China. And there got to be, I think, somewhat near panic about this. People were told to wear masks, to isolate it. They were told not to go to work. People were hospitalized. We heard reports of people dying in the hospital. And so there was a very, the atmosphere was very frightening. The government went into a full court press and tried to develop a vaccine very rapidly with the pharmaceutical companies. And eventually, toward the end of 2020, some vaccines began to emerge. And there were some other alternatives, but we were told they were not very valuable. And then a massive effort was made to vaccinate the population. And there was not only one set of vaccinations, usually there were two, there were multiple sets of vaccinations. People experienced loved ones who were dying, or people knew about that. They seemed to be getting the same experience from around the world. As time went on, this is what happened. Eventually, the virus seemed to peter out, or the disease seemed to peter out, and some of the restrictions were reduced or eliminated. But there then cropped up as a series of questions and evidence saying, well, maybe this isn't all as bad as it seems to be. And there was different types of reporting about it. Some reported very serious problems, others reported it's not that serious. And so we get to the question of what is the truth, which is fundamentally what we're trying to do in Surgical Neurology International, Surgical Neurology, SNI Digital. That's what this is being recorded on. So we decided that it would be worthwhile to have an interview with somebody who was very knowledgeable about this, happens to be a neurosurgeon who is very versed in many of these disease processes, has been way ahead of his time in many predictions. So we can ask him, and he's written many papers on this, books on this, about COVID-19 and its complications, as his own publication, healthcare publication. And that's Russell Blaylock. Russell, do you want to tell people about your background a little bit, or did I cover it?
Well, you covered it pretty well. I graduated from LSU Medical School in the 70s, and I did a straight surgery internship. And after that, I did a neurosurgery residency in South Carolina. And I practiced neurosurgery. I've always been interested in neuroscience. And also everything connected with it. Dr. Gennato was a person I knew very well. And I used to scrub with him. And he said, a neurosurgeon should know everything about medicine. And I took that to heart. I learned general medicine. I learned how to treat diabetes. I learned how to give steroids, do other surgical procedures. You and I pretty much agree on that. And that has been what I've been interested in. So I don't limit myself just to neurosurgery, which is very interesting, but brain function, spinal cord function, virology, bacteriology, all of these disciplines that in some way might impact the health.
Well, okay. And it turns out that COVID-19 does involve the central nervous system. You're going to tell us about that. And obviously other systems that that are impact on the health and things that you've written about over the years. So why don't we get started? Because I think the audience wants to know, I think what we'd like to do is take everybody through it from starting about questions about what is the actually, what is the virus? How bad is it? They heard questions about that it was made in the laboratory. How did it get out? How did it spread around the world? What do people know about it? What's its genetic sequence? How did the government get involved in all this? Is the virus really as bad as what it is? And do we need all the protective measures we had? And then after that, the vaccine. What do we know about the vaccine? Is it like all the other vaccines we're told to take, or is it more dangerous? You've written a lot about vaccines over the years. It was made in record time, so the public could be safe from this. We need to know what are the doctors who are listening to this, or even some of the lay public, what else is in this vaccine? Need to know about that. And what do we know about it? Where does it go in the body? We were told it was localized initially, but you've written about this. Others have written about it. It's distributed all throughout the body. And what about these other drugs we were told about that you, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, you can't use them. They're not very good and they're toxic and so forth. Is that true? And then how bad is the disease? How was it? Did it cause a lot of deaths? Everybody was tested. They know you had to go in the car or go to the hospital, keep getting the PCR testing. Was the testing worthwhile? What part did the hospital play in this with the respirators? And we read some things that the hospitals were being paid extra amount of money for taking care of these people. The medical journals, did they report about it? And if not, what happened? We know there's some evidence that's saying all this information was suppressed. And now we're two years, 3 years down the line, and we're seeing complications that are occurring. What are these complications? How bad are they? And what does it mean to all of us? So we're going to try to do this, and you and I have talked about this, and in about the next hour or so, to give the doctors who really didn't get a lot of information about it, what is the truth about COVID-19? What do I really need to know? Is the information I have out of date, or was it correct to begin with? And let's start with the virus. What is this a bad virus to begin with? It's supposed to be a virus like the cold virus. It's a coronavirus. Can you tell us what we need to know about it? And we'll go from there.
Well, from the very beginning, it was shrouded in secrecy. Initially, when the virus came out, I was watching what was happening in China, and people were just falling down, and they'd be walking along perfectly healthy and fall down. And then we found out that was actually fake photos, and that the Chinese government had faked them. And the physician who first discovered the coronavirus in China and its effect on people, he reported it. And the Chinese government let him know very soon, we don't want this reported. You keep quiet. Well, he had already published it, and he quickly came down with COVID. They put him in the hospital, and in a short time, he was dead. He was a fairly young physician. Then they sequestered all the information about the virus. We had all kinds of information from the Wuhan bioweapons lab, which was a bioweapons lab, run by the Chinese Communist military. They took all the information about the virus and hid it and destroyed it. And it had been published years before, but it was too late. That was in the Western literature. Very quickly, the virus began to spread to other countries. And no one knew anything about this virus except it was a coronavirus. And as you said, there's a group of coronaviruses, and most are, you know, pretty benign. The cold virus, about maybe as high as 4-5%, 10% are coronaviruses every year, have been for decades. People get a little sick, a few days, they're well. And So President Trump made the comment when this all started out and started to spread. He said, this is nothing to worry about. It's no worse than the flu. The mortality is not worse than the flu. Well, there were several epidemiologists who were looking at this. There were some virologists in foreign countries who were looking at this. They eventually said everything Trump said was true, that the mortality was very low. Now, there are coronaviruses produce a death, but they also affect the very same group of people, the same age group, same frailty, same disease states. And they found out that young people didn't get it, or they were not affected by it, and that they recovered very quickly and they didn't transmit it, and this virus died out. Well, most people know this in virology, is that if a virus is a very fatal virus, generally it dies out. The viruses that's going to spread, particularly worldwide, are those that are more benign, because it doesn't kill the host. And some of the early people said, well, we don't know anything about this virus. Why don't we type it and find out what the amino acid sequence is in? Well, the government did everything in its power to keep that from being done. But a few people did that, and they said, what we found in this virus, it's been artificially created. Well, it was created in the Wuhan bioweapons lab of the Chinese Communist Party. It was not an independent lab. It was not a free lab. It was a bioweapons lab. Then it gradually came out. We're learning more and more about the sequence. And one of the high ranking immunologists at National Institutes of Health, Kirsten Anderson, immediately put out an email. I've looked at this virus. I've typed it. And it looks like it was artificially created. Immediately, he was attacked by Fauci and some of the people in the NIH, and the next day he changed the story that this was a completely natural virus, and it jumped from an animal, a bat, and later a pangolin, to a human. So people were curious, well, why did you change your story? Your first response was, there's no question this was created. This is not a natural virus, and it did not come from an animal. Well, as we all remember, in the very beginning, everything was about a wet market in China. And they were selling bats, particularly live bats, and that this is where the coronavirus began, and then it spread through China, and then it spread to the rest of the world. The problem was, they finally tracked down patient zero, which is where it all started. He never visited wet market. The wet market said, we didn't sell any bats. Unfortunately, the Chinese government didn't allow time to cover that up, and it got out. And so two things were evident. One, the first patient that was reported to have the COVID infection in China had never been to the wet market. Number two, the wet market didn't sell bats. So that story for a while kind of fell through, and recently they've tried to resurrect it. Then they changed it. Oh, it came from this animal, a pangolin. That's kind of fallen through as well. So eventually we realize this story is not consistent. There's something wrong with it. The thing that was wrong with it, basically, all you had to do is to see what the Chinese Communist government did. They locked down the city of Wuhan. They wouldn't let anybody out, anybody in. They were trying to make the impression that they were going to keep it local. But they didn't stop international flights. So you could take international flights out of this infected area of China, as long as you wouldn't spread it to the rest of China. And so very quickly, we started to see it. Well, one of the places it went to was Italy. And I just happened to read a report by an Italian reporter who they said was probably one of the best reporters they had. And he examined it and he said, you know, the death from flu is the highest in northern Italy, because the local press made a big deal about COVID is killing more people in northern Italy than anywhere in the world. It's changed and there's something about it. And he said, that's nonsense. It's the most polluted place in Europe. It always exceeds the rest of Europe in flu deaths. And that this is no different. Well, finally, they did autopsies on these people in northern Italy, and they found out, well, these all were elderly. Almost all of them were either in their 80s or 90s. And they found at autopsy, they died of their comorbid disease. They didn't die of the COVID. And that on average, they had 3 to 4 comorbid diseases. That was found here as well in other countries, Germany, Belgium, the different places. They started looking and said, well, you know, almost all these people at the are near the end of their life, they have 3 or 4 comorbid diseases. They're very sick. They're very frail. They're not healthy elderly. And in Italy, they had, I think, 2 cases of people that were 101 years old. They got COVID and they recovered just fine. They didn't have any problem. So people began to smell a rat. Well, they still didn't want this sequence. They didn't want to know what the virus did and what it was consistent of. Was this a natural virus or was this created in a laboratory? Well, finally, somebody did the sequencing and they found out there's no question that this was artificially created. And recently it's come out, well, they found a smoking gun called endonuclease, which is used to slice these RNA molecules and make insertions. And they said it's obvious that other viral sequences have been inserted in this virus. One of these is HIV. And recently they did a study and found out 24% of the people that had the spike protein injected in them through the vaccine came out HIV positive. And so they said, well, maybe they had HIV. So they tested HIV and they didn't find any. So it was confirmed that it was inserted in this virus sequence. So now we have absolute proof beyond any doubt that it was artificially created in this bioweapons lab. Now, the really scary thing was that they couldn't do it by themselves. They tried to infect animals, particularly pulmonary tissues, with the COVID virus they had created. They couldn't infect the animal. And so Ralph Barrick, who is a immunologist at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, he created a type of mouse that had human lung tissue. And then he found that you could infect that lung tissue with this virus. And so he shared that with the Chinese Communist bioweapons lab. And they were able to design this virus that would attach to the ACE2 receptor, enter the cell, and produce the infection. But even so, when we looked at all the data and we looked at the graphs of people who were not sick, not frail, didn't have comorbid diseases, their death rate was no different than a mild flu, at best a moderate flu. And they declared it a pandemic. Well, then you started looking at, the World Health Organization declared it a world pandemic. Well, there's certain criteria that you have to meet to be a pandemic. And when they looked at the criteria, they said, well, number one, it not only has to spread around the world, because COVID virus spreads around the world every year, it has to kill people, have to be dangerous. They have to get seriously ill. Then it's a pandemic. And if it doesn't spread all over the world and it does not produce serious pathological change, even though it's a virus that goes everywhere, it's not a pandemic. Well, this virus did not meet the criteria of a pandemic. Yet the World Health Organization and our American government declared it a pandemic.
Let me stop you there. Let me stop you there, man, because you covered a lot of ground. Let me just summarize it, so maybe ask some questions. First thing audience is going to say is, I understand what you said. Is there a factual basis for all the statements you've made? And one of them is we wrote a book together on this, which detail this almost day by day from the very time you started with this up for the next year and a half or so in print, and everything is documented. That's number one. Number two, you mentioned that the virus was laboratory made. There's been all kinds of controversy about that. And the government has said, well, nobody knows where it's from. They thought it was from the market. You addressed that. They even shut the markets down, but it still occurred outside the market, just as you mentioned. And finally, they've begun to agree that, well, it may have come from the laboratory. And that's just in the last months or so that they've begun to agree that. But that's been covered up also. So I'm coming to a question is, why is all the cover up? And so there's, from what you said, there's evidence that we can use to support every statement. In the papers you've written or in the book that we have, there's evidence that supports every comment that you've made. I think we get down to the first question is, what is this virus? It's a changed coronavirus. It's been changed in the laboratory, but still what you're saying is the virulence. The threat of this virus is still minuscule. It's very small. Even the CDC, when it published its data, said that the death rate from the virus alone, even this modified virus, could only account for less than 1%, and even smaller than that, of all the deaths. So it was from the comorbidities. But yet that was being used as a method of apparently inducing fear in the public. Is all of that that I said, is that summary correct?
It's right, accurate to the dot. There's nothing.
So now we're through the virus. We've established the virus is man-made, and it basically is still a coronavirus. It's not virulent. And now we get into the next phase, which is the government's going through all kinds of protective measures. You got to wear masks. You have to social distance. You got to stay home. You can't be treated. If you go to the hospital, we got to isolate you. And all that. You want to talk about the public and government reaction to what was now called a pandemic, but you just established it wasn't. Because people weren't dying from it. They were dying from other comorbidities. And all this was being obviously amplified for the public. So what were about the protective measurements? What was the basis for that?
Well, if we look at it, and that was obvious as well. For instance, if you looked at Sweden and Norway, one country did all of these protective things, these so-called protective devices, PPP, to protect the public, masks and washing their hands and social distancing, all it's lockdown, all this nonsense. And then you see a country that shares a border that did none of these things. The mortality of COVID was no different. It did nothing. And if you remember, Fauci said, all I need is we need to lock down for 2 weeks because we just don't want the hospital to overrun. Well, I that rang a bell in my head because we had the H1N1 event before that. And I was interviewed and they asked me, said, well, do you think it's proper that they do some measures to keep it from overwhelming the hospital? They were talking about respirators, the whole business. This is long before COVID. And I made the statement, don't worry about it. There's not going to be any hospitals overrun. There won't be any need for the excess respirators. It's all nonsense. And I was the only one saying it. I was on one of the networks wanting to interview me, and after they heard that, they canceled it. They talked to somebody that terrified people, that, oh, it's going to overwhelm everything. Well, what I had done is looked at the south south of the equator in the southern hemisphere. They have their winter before us, and they have the flu season before us. And if you looked at Australia, New Zealand, there wasn't any of these fearful things happening. Hospitals weren't overrun. There wasn't a need for excess respirators. It passed, and it was no different than any other flu season. So it turned out I was right. The hospitals weren't overrun. There wasn't a need for the respirators. It was all nonsense. And so then when I saw this, I said, it's going to happen again. They had Ford Motor Company, General Motors, making respirators, first time in their life. They were just inundated millions and millions of dollars worth of respirators. The hospitals were going to be overworked, and the news media was showing the hospitals, the workers were just exhausted from working. Then I found out, well, you know, there's a videotape. We have hospitals that are empty. They cordoned them off like a crime scene so people couldn't get in and see if the emergency room was empty. One intrepid person got in the hospital and got up on the floors, and it was empty. Now we found out that back then, 2 years ago, several of the hospitals had zero number of COVID patients. Other hospitals had numerous ones. What they were doing, putting them all in one patient in one hospital, so they could have the media come in, videotape them, and say, look, we're overrun. Well, you and I did a residency, and when I was a resident, we were always overrun. We always had patients in the hall. We always had patients on stretchers in the hall. So that wasn't new. That happened every year. So what we saw is there's a lot of theatrics going on. And this lockdown was costing money. These businesses were shut down. Restaurants were shut down. They were closed permanently. Now we're having these economic discussions about the cost of all this. These are something like half of the businesses have closed their doors permanently. This has had a tremendous economic impact on people. School children were learning from home on computers. Now, almost everybody involved in businesses was losing money, except for a few. If you look at Silicon Valley, they made billions. You know what they made billions off of? Well, you can't leave your house. You need to get on Amazon. You need to get on these special sites. And you need to teach and buy computers and teach your kids from a computer. So they made billions. That was recently on Tucker Carlson program. He reviewed all of that. So not everybody was destroyed, but they destroyed the middle class, the smaller business, the restaurants, the people who worked in restaurants. They lost their job. They have no job. So this went far beyond what they were telling people. And then we started looking at it, and like you said, the mortality rate was even less than the flu. And for the first time, it didn't affect young people. And they were amazed. They said, well, we thought this was going to kill the little kids, babies, children. It didn't. In fact, they didn't transmit it, and they didn't catch it. It was far less than 1% incidence.
Let me stop you here for a minute, and then we can catch up. So what we've got is that you've talked about the effects. One thing I'm going to ask you, because you wrote about this, you've written about every aspect of this. What was the effect of the masks, and what was the evidence behind it?
There was no evidence. And in fact, they recently reviewed the evidence on the social distancing, the separator. He said it was just pulled out of thin air. And what the experts were saying, this is an aerosolized virus. And so coughing and sneezing is not the problem. It's aerosolized, which goes 27 feet. So if you were on a bus, you'd have to stand outside the bus not to spread it. So the mask did no good. The other thing was the size of the virus passed right through the mask. And recently it's come evident, one of the things, I wrote one of the first articles about the mask when this all started. A friend of mine that's asked me to write it. And I researched all of this, and I found out, well, the virus passed through the mask for the most part. It's not coughing and sneezing that causes it. And most people don't know how to wear a mask. It leaks. It goes around the face, and they've demonstrated that with smoke and different ways to show that the mask has the aerosol go everywhere. It contaminates store shelves. It contaminates the person next to you, behind you. So the mask was absolutely worthless. Well, they had people who were experts in bioengineering, and they said they had studied the mask for years, and it's completely worthless. And I look back at 17 studies that were done on the flu virus and mask, and what these studies showed is that they even had people sleeping in a mask, wearing their mask at home, not just working out at public, but in the home, sleeping in. And it had no real effect.
You also wrote about the fact that if you have a mask, and this can affect people with comorbidities, it makes you retain CO2 because you can't expire it.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, what I found is in the literature, people start retaining CO2 and have trouble oxygenating. And so they studied surgeons, because surgeons wear masks while they're doing the surgery. And they looked at all ages wearing a mask during surgery, and they measured their oxygen intake. And they found out if it was over 4 hours, they were severely or significantly impaired. Now, it was age-related. The older you are, particularly if you have comorbid disease and you wear a mask, it's deleterious. If you're pregnant, it's deleterious. And when I looked at pregnancy, they have special mechanisms to prevent hypoxia because it's so damaging to the baby. Here you're wearing a mask, producing hypoxia, damaging the development of the baby's brain. And we know that that even extends 2 years after birth. The last trimester in the first 2 years is when most brain development occurs. So we knew all of this. And so people started measuring, well, what is the oxygen level in a mask? They found it was extremely low. The other thing was they did a study in Florida, and they looked at contamination of the mask. That is, it gets wet from your breathing and nasal secretion. They found, I forgot, something like 17 pathogenic bacteria. So these people were getting mask acne. They were getting abscesses of the face. And this recently, someone looking at it and said, well, and I put this in my paper, they're rebreathing the virus. The virus goes through the olfactory nerves into the brain. There's no blood-brain barrier between the olfactory nerves and the entrance to the brain. It goes to the hippocampus, which is your memory and learning, and it goes to the frontal lobes. Now, that was well known. I was one of the first people to say it's going to get in the brain by the nasal passages. And I had a friend of mine that's head of a group in Arizona, and I told him that. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, he said, that's just come out. You were right. It's going through the nasal passages. And so, you know, I had studied the nasal passages and entry into the brain for some other research I was looking at. And so I knew it. So the danger is you're rebreathing the virus because of the mask. And it's not only in your nasal cavity, now it's getting into your olfactory nerve, and it's going into your brain, and it's concentrated.
So let's stop here for a minute. So what we've established so far, and there's absolute evidence to support every one of these statements. It's in the papers, which we'll show at the end, and we'll put in the end of the of this program so people can copy them and look for them. We've shown that the virus itself, even the manufactured virus in its genetically altered form, is still not very toxic. It's not a serious infection. Okay, and we have all the evidence to support that. Now we have the reactive measures of wearing a mask. You just said that's ineffective. The social distancing didn't make any sense, but practically it couldn't be implemented. So they made it. They chose a figure at 6 feet or 5 feet. These little circles they had on the floor where you had to stand, they were meaningless because the virus already got there, and it spread to almost 30 feet. You've already talked about that. There was no protective measures that would be helpful, and so now we're down. We've gotten to the public home. They're isolated. They're away from work. Businesses are closing. Now the vaccine comes on the market. And they're publishing every day, they're publishing the statistics of the virus, and they show, did they have PCR testing at that time, early on, before the vaccine?
Oh, yeah, well before that. In fact, the inventor of the PCR talked about it.
So what they did is they had a test which would then measure if you had the virus in your passages. But people interpreted that, or they were made to interpret that you were infected and ill. But the facts are, you correct me if I'm wrong, is that these are people who just had evidence that it was there, and we don't even know if that was at a dosage that was severe enough. And it didn't say that it was a serious infection or disease. So the data that was being put out was basically deceiving the public. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. And it goes further. Yeah. I mean, of course, the developer of the PCR test, he made the statement. He said, you never use PCR tests to diagnose an infection. He said, that's ludicrous. And he said, the PCR test can't tell the difference between a viral fragment, a live virus, or a dead virus.
Right.
And he said, so you're testing people. They may just have a fragment in it that's not infectious, and it doesn't tell you they're sick or not. Yeah. And so what they did is they tested virtually everybody in a store, in a hospital. People were in car accidents, automobile bills, out of suicides, all kinds of things. In the hospital, they tested with PCR testing. And then they would say, oh, it's positive. And what they've shown, it cross-reacts. It'll cross-react with any coronavirus, and it'll cross-react, they found out, even with the flu virus. So it's not specific, and it can't tell the difference between a live virus and a dead virus.
Okay, so now we're setting the stage because out comes the vaccine. So can you tell us a little bit about what is the vaccine, what's in it, how does it work? You inject it, and the company's told us it's, if you got it, it stayed in a certain location. You have to have two shots, not one. And then how long did it last? And where was it distributed? And that, can you talk about those things?
Yeah, a number of virologists, and as you said in the introduction, most of our virologists were in foreign countries. Some of the world-renowned virologists, for instance, Dr. Bossi, who I've talked with, and Dr. Cardi, he's written a book, and I read his book and I watched his interviews. He was arrested for speaking out. And so both of these people said that this is a ludicrous thing. He said, if you would not treat it, not wear a mask, it's so benign. In a short time, everybody would be immune to it, and this would all be over.
So the natural immunity was being ignored.
It was absolutely. They had numerous physicians. They had two physicians who started out talking about that. They were very popular. People were listening to them. They threw them out of their medical association, and they took their license away.
Okay, let's go to the vaccine. Now, they make the vaccine up, and the companies are incentivized because they get paid by the government for making the vaccine. They got to make millions and millions and millions of doses so everybody can be injected and also can go to foreign countries. What is what's in the vaccine? It's a virus. What's the structure? What's in there? What are the components that are in there? Tell us a little bit about that. So we've already dealt with the virus. What's about the vaccine?
Well, it's not really a vaccine. And this is the point that people make. It's a genetic product. And what they wanted to do is try this new idea, which was a messenger RNA injection. And they designed the messenger RNA, but they knew that the body has an RNA ACE, which destroys it quickly. And so they wanted encapsulated in a nanolipid carrier. It's just like a little box that puts it in. It puts it in a little bubble. It's made of lipids. And it stays inside there, and it's protected against the enzyme. And originally, they said, well, it stays exactly where we inject it. It won't go anywhere. The media pirouetted that immediately over and over. It stays right in the arm. And recently, the developer of nanolipid carrier said, we knew from the beginning that was a lie. It goes everywhere. They have studied, and they found out that the manufacturer of this vaccine, so-called vaccine, had studied this before they released it, before it was approved under emergency authorization, a biodistribution study. This biodistribution study showed it went everywhere. It's particularly concentrated in the female ovary and everybody's bone marrow. But it went everywhere, even in the brain. They found it everywhere. So they knew before it was ever approved from this biodistribution study, they did, that that was a lie. And the media carried that lie. And when it was pointed out, they ignored it.
Let me ask you, did the companies do pathology studies? Because I don't remember that they're commonly published on the animals that they tested the vaccine that were quote vaccine they were developing, the viral fragment or the RNA vaccine. Tell me about that.
No, it's never published. They don't publish any of this. In fact, they had gone to court. People were trying to get a FOLA, a federal request, for this information from the vaccine company. The companies went to the court, asked the court to give them a 25-year, it would be hidden. Then they changed it to 75 years. They would be long gone by the time this information was released. And of course, anybody has any sense would say, why did you want this information hidden even for 25 years? You had done these studies. You didn't publish them. You didn't release the raw data. You refused to release the full data. And then you want it hidden for 75 years.
Now, at the same time, these people who are theoretically dying, or not theoretically, who are dying and supposedly related to the virus, there are no autopsy studies. Why did that happen? I mean, in America, I think there's been a decreasing percentage of autopsies, but I think there's still 6 to 10%, something like that, but nothing was happening. What happened?
Well, generally we know, everybody in medicine knows, your most accurate diagnosis, if you want to learn the most about a disease, is the autopsy. For the first time in the history of modern medicine, autopsies were discouraged. The CDC came out and told pathologists, don't do autopsies here and in foreign countries. And so for the first time, they were not doing them. And the pathologists were literally screaming, we need more autopsies. We need series of autopsies, large numbers. They were asking for 80, up to 80 autopsies. The government didn't want them to autopsy anybody. The pathologist said, we've looked at the data And the excuse was, well, they're afraid that the pathologists get infected from the dead that died of COVID. They found there was only one pathologist who even got sick from doing an autopsy, and he had it before he did the autopsy. So that was shown to be false. That was a lie. Well, then when they did the autopsy, they found out why. And what the autopsy does is, number one, is it tells whether the doctor made a mistake, whether the doctor's treatment, whether the hospital's treatment, whether the nurse's treatment led to the patient's death and had nothing to do with the virus. They didn't want that discovered. If you remember, they were paying extra to put COVID as the cause of death on death certificate. First time ever. I'm 78 years old. I remember never being told what to put on a death certificate to fill it out. Suddenly, hospitals were telling physicians, I don't care what they died from, put COVID on. We get paid extra for it if you make it a COVID death. And they one of the senators had a hearing. He said 40% of the death certificates died of something else, heart attack. One was actually shot and killed in an assault. One had committed suicide, a motorcycle accident, on and on and on. And they wanted them signed out as a COVID death for several reasons. One, immediately they got more money, but it made the so-called pandemic look much worse. It instilled fear. Look at all these refrigerated trucks full of dead bodies. Look at these hospitals overrun with the dead dying of COVID. And they knew that was a lie, that many of those people, particularly in nursing homes, these people were dying of other things. They didn't die of COVID.
Okay, let me interrupt you here. So we got to the virus, or we got to this, and there's a little story about that. I think not recently, within the past, I think year or year and a half, it was revealed that the definition of a vaccine was changed to accommodate this new RNA sequence that they were manufacturing so that it could then pass under the restriction of being a vaccine. Can you explain that?
Well, it's not strictly a vaccine because a vaccine is supposed to prevent a disease in the person and prevent transmission. It did neither. So it met none of the definitions of a vaccine. It did not prevent transmission, did not prevent disease. So you say, well, why are you calling this a vaccine? And then you've got genetic structure in it. See, for years, they've wanted to make a DNA vaccine and the RNA vaccine. The DNA vaccine was just terrible, a failure. It just didn't work. They're still trying to make it. And the RNA vaccine was only for in the research world, to try to make a vaccine for cancer. It's never intended for a virus. The problem with the vaccine is it generates the spike protein. That's the purpose of the messenger RNA, is it generates spike protein. Well, the spike protein is the toxic part of the virus. It's not the nucleocapsid. It's the spike protein. That's the harmful part. And so you have an injection that is generating the most harmful part of the virus. So, and it does it continuously.
What they're assuming when they made this is they were going to make an RNA, they're going to manufacture in the laboratory an RNA virus. They put in there the spike protein and could have had the HIV or some other things. You'll tell me about that in a minute. That then does not stay in the arm. It's distributed throughout the body. It gets into the cellular tissues. You haven't gotten to this yet, but if it gets into the cellular tissues, where does it go from there? And does it become part of the RNA and then the DNA of the individual? So you have an individual then who can begin to generate this spike protein for their entire life. We haven't studied it that long, but at least as long as it's been studied, I think people have found that. So that's the vaccine. The vaccine has the RNA sequence, which contains mostly the spike protein. Does it have some other things? Does it have an HIV sequence in it?
It does, and there's other things being found in this vaccine that they've consistently denied, graphene oxide. They denied there was any graphene oxide in it. Well, a group of researchers at the universities, I think it was three universities in Spain, universities from other countries, all discovered, yes, it contains graphene oxide. Well, graphene oxide, if not reduced, is extremely harmful if it oxidizes. Well, if it's freely floating in your blood, there's a good chance it's going to become oxidized and produce damage. So there's more in it than just the messenger RNA. Then a researcher who's a molecular biologist from the university that I did my neurosurgery runs at, the University of South Carolina, he found it contained thousands of bits of DNA, circular DNA that is incorporated in the person's DNA. Initially, even if we discount all that and just talk about the messenger RNA, a researcher said, we found out that it reverse incorporates the messenger RNA into a DNA. They denied it, and the news media carried it that there's no evidence of DNA insertion. Well, this was published, and it is in the medical literature that it does indeed undergo this reverse transcription into the DNA. And that would mean not only is that person producing the spike protein from then on, he can transmit it to his offspring.
Gosh. So now we know now the vaccine, we know what this quote vaccine or pseudo vaccine, maybe that's the way to put it that way. What it does is produces a spike protein. It's got some DNA contamination. It has some other metal products in the injection also, which could be harmful. None of these things are known. They didn't do testing in animals long enough to discover all this, did they?
Well, they do hardly any animal testing. They just did the biodistribution study. The rest of it, they didn't do. And this is what people are making the point of, and they're right, is the human beings, the people in the safety test and that are being vaccinated now, or they're the test animal.
Because none of the vaccines that are now being promoted today, and this is now ahead of the history where we've just talking about, have been tested in humans. The vaccine that is being promoted today for COVID has not been tested in animals. That's been written, I think, in the news, but that is a fact, right?
That's right.
And all the things, again, we've talked about, you've talked about, you've written in the papers, these are facts that can be determined. Okay, now we've got the individual who's got the, quote, the virus, which we know is not harmful. We know that people with comorbidities don't do well. We know they're being isolated, put on masks and so forth. Businesses are being shut down, would have no effect on this. We know that the deaths that are being reported are being exaggerated. We've just established that. We know that the testing, it does not test for the live virus or for illness. So we know that. Now what happens is there are two parts. One is the acute part. In other words, some people were infected with the virus itself and became acutely ill. They went to the hospital. They weren't treated with anything because they said there was no drug they could treat you with. And they waited till the last minute to try some things. Some people were put on steroids, on ventilators, but that's where the death rate occurred. So is there an acute reaction to the virus itself? And then we're talking about the second set of reactions, which are to the vaccine, which is producing the spike protein. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Is the acute reaction that people had, some of these people went to the hospital and they immediately got worse and died. Was this because of their genetic predisposition to this? They didn't have a good immune system. What were some of the explanations for that?
Well, the people who became significantly ill, they did have immune suppression. And I want to tell people this. The number one immune suppressor that the American public is taking in large doses, millions of people, are statins. Statins are such powerful immune suppressing agents that one of the transplant surgeons said, we ought to use it on transplant patients to keep them from rejecting organs. So here you have tens of millions of people on an immune suppressant, particularly older people, and now you give them a minor virus. And I told people, if you take just a common cold virus in a nursing home, the mortality is 8%. That's significant. That exceeds the COVID virus. So we know that it's related to immune function. If you have a good immune system, that's why young people don't get affected. They have good immune systems.
And I think they did have some pathology studies of those acute deaths, and they found that there was an overwhelming immune reaction, just an excessive, and you've talked about this as an excessive super immune response, which killed the patient, basically. Is that correct?
Yeah, we generally call that a cytokine storm.
Yeah, cytokine storm.
And what happens to these people is they came into the hospital. I put in my paper, and Corey talked about it, is this is the first infection ever in my memory that we said, well, don't treat the patient until they're seriously ill, until they're hospitalized. That's never been done before. Just take Tylenol and drink some water, and then if you get really sick, go to the hospital. Well, these patients, people did that. They went to the hospital, and they weren't that bad off. They're a little short of breath, and they said it was unusual. We've never seen this. Shortness of breath, or the oxygen level was low, and they were talking. They said they weren't in distress. They weren't panicked. He said usually people who have very low oxygen levels are in a panic. And so one of the young medicine doctors who was in one of the emergency rooms, he said, well, why don't we just give them high flow oxygen instead of put them on a respirator? And, we're afraid it'll spread the COVID everywhere. Well, it was everywhere because they showed that it's everywhere in an emergency room and in the intensive care unit. So he took a group of patients and he put them on just oxygen by high flow, not by a respirator. They did very well. And these people will have, McCullough talks about this, he said, you can see people with a blood gas, a PO2 of 40, and they're no distress. They're perfectly comfortable. So he just raised it by oxygen flow, and they did fine. The ones on respirators, the mortality was 80 or 90%. The hospital was paid extra, a lot of money per patient, if you put them on a respirator. So they told all the doctors, you either put them on a respirator or we'll remove you. So they started putting people on respirators, and they had an enormous death rate, and they blamed it on COVID. They weren't dying of COVID. They were dying of the imposed treatment. Now, who imposed these standards? The CDC, Center for Disease Control. And as I said in my paper, they've never treated a single patient. And they made a protocol. The experienced surgeons, experienced people out in the world, treated thousands of patients, had almost no deaths. One of them treated 1,000 patients and he had one death. And something like 6 hospitalizations out of 1,000. They didn't ask him to make the protocol. They didn't ask the experts who are experts in pulmonary medicine to make the protocol. They asked people in the CDC who had never treated a soul. And it became absolute at every hospital. Right here in Mississippi, they had one of the doctors decided he wasn't going to give the drug that they wanted to give. He wanted to give ivermectin. They not only took away his hospital privileges, but they carried him out of the hospital with two hospital employees as if he was a criminal. We've had people who had their license removed when they insisted, I want to treat them different. Now, Pierre Corey is an expert in pulmonary medicine. He's treated thousands of cases. And he said, what we find is there's intense inflammation in the lungs. And if you treat them with steroids and don't put them on a respirator, they get well, most of them, by far. The American College of Thoracic Surgeons came out, or thoracic medicine came out and said, don't put anybody on steroids. And so hospitals wouldn't let anybody put patients on steroids. They were giving patients by order drugs that were supposed to suppress breathing. And then their oxygenation would falter, then they put them on a respirator, and then they die, and then they get paid more money. Now, as I tell in the paper, what you find is that a large number of hospitals are going bankrupt. And so they in desperate, desperate need for money. So they'll do these things. And when I wrote this paper, I even heard from a hospital administrator who had quit. And he said, that's just what we saw, just what we experienced. This went all over the world, and they all said the same thing. 99% of it. This is exactly what we experienced.
This is the end of part one of this interview. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional.